Hey now, welcome to the Dirty Side of the Track, America's leading Formula One podcast. You know who we are. I'm Brian, that's Rob. We're excited to have you along with us, Dirty Siders, this week. It is a non-race week, but we have some great content and material we want to hit for you today. Rob, do you want to give the listeners a little preview of what's to come?
Yeah, sure. We are going to do news and social roundup. We then have another installment in Vale's Tales, where Brian is going to dive into the world that is Fangio. One of his kind of things he's always wanted to look into. Every start we're doing this Vale's Tales, he's like, I'm going to do Fangio 1 week. I'm definitely going to do Fangio 1 week. So this is the week of Fangio.
And the story of Fangio does not disappoint. Let me just say that.
Oh, now you're really building it up. Mm-hmm. Then we're going to do the Spanish preview, being as that's where we're going to go racing next week. We've got a 100 seconds of DRS guest, which is fantastic. And then we'll just see out the week by giving a little bit of a reminder about fantasy and some Rob versus Brian updates, which if we haven't got time for it, we can just leave it.
We'll make time. We should make time for that. We should definitely make a lot of time for that.
By the way, before we jump into the news and social, so I was just telling you, Brian, before we start recording, that I've managed to get my I earned my man badge today, and I managed to get my ride on mower to work again. And much despite the fact that my wife thought there was no chance I was going to get this thing, because I don't have the greatest track record of being mechanically minded, but I got this thing set up, and our grass has not been mowed this year. So as I was going around just testing this thing out to make sure it was doing okay, I was kind of like driving around, and I kind of had this idea that I should have tried to mow like a track outline into the... Unfortunately, it didn't hit me. I would have needed way more preparation. But as I was kind of going around, I was just doing random circles around the yard. I was like, oh man, this would have been epic to have done like a racetrack.
Well, I will say this. You should have. When I was younger, living in Florida, my buddy Dan and I... saved up some money and holiday money, and we bought remote control cars, and there was a vacant lot near our houses, and we turned it into a dirt track for the remote control cars. It was epic. So I guess it's racing's always been in my blood. It's in your blood, but you screwed it up, man. Next time, do better. All right.
I did. This time, when I let it grow again, I'll have enough time while that grass is growing to plan out what the optimum circuit is that fits my back garden. So, and then I'll take some pictures and share them. It'll be great.
That's great.
Or it'll be a disaster, but you know, we'll see. Anyway, on to news and social. The first thing that we've got on here, I've got to be honest, I kind of did a bit of a double take because I didn't know it was happening, and I saw that Sebastian Vettel had been on Question Time, which is a BBC kind of politics show. I was like, what? What is Seb doing on Question Time? And I kind of watched it, and I've got to be honest, he came across really well.
He's a brilliant guy, I think, right? I mean, isn't that pretty well known? He's very reflective and thoughtful.
Yes, very articulate and kind of seems very intelligent. And he was basically kind of trying to sum up the kind of almost hypocrisy that he has inside himself, where he fully believes in kind of looking to battle climate change and also knows that every time he steps into a racing car, he loves racing it. But when he gets out of it, he knows the impact that the sport has on the planet. So he's really kind of pushing big on this whole, we should do better to have the calendar aligned more to countries. A bit like me and you have said before, it would make more sense not to keep flying from one side of the world to the other, kind of do all the European ones, then move somewhere else, then kind of hit all USA, Canada, Mexico, just kind of reduce the amount of flying around would be like step number one. But yeah, he came across kind of really well in it, to be honest.
Well, you know, just one quick note. I saw a stat, and I'll get it for next time. But the cars themselves, the emission and what they burn and all of the components is minimal compared to the footprint left behind by traveling around the world. The planes, flying the gear back and forth, to the point we've made, why not sort of geolocate your way around as opposed to back and forth? That's really the worst part of F1. From a carbon perspective, and what we're doing to the planet is the back and forth on the planes, the containers, the boxes getting everywhere. It's not the driving of the cars. Still, we love the fact it's a turbo hybrid era. They're burning less fuel. It's more efficient. All the teams are up to, 10% ethanol now. So continuing to, I may have that one wrong, but continuing to make a progress. But it was cool. He was on, was it in London? Is that where they filmed that?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
So what is
I don't know where it's filmed. The BBC have many, many studios. There are ones in London, so let's just say Question Time is in the London studios.
Well, he was either on the tube or on a train of some flavor on his way to the episode, and people caught him and took some pictures of him. So he was at least trying to reduce his carbon footprint to the interview.
Now, talking about reducing emissions and burning things, story came up that this... Well, sorry. This has come through two opposite channels. One set of things set Twitter alight with, Red Bull has burnt through 2/3 of its development budget already. That's why they're so good right now, but they've got nothing left for the rest of the year. And then almost instantly, the other half of Twitter went, no, they haven't. And it was just one of those classic he said, she said type things where I tried to do some digging around. But I mean, I don't think you're ever going to find anything that helps you back it up, because it's not like Horner's going to be leaving his notepad open with a big thing saying action item for Monday morning, right. Resolve 2/3 of budget already spent.
Did he leave the Red Bull checkbook on a train somewhere and people looked like, oh boy.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, it was just one of those things that just kind of, I don't know whether just somebody threw it out there with no substance behind it, but it was just one of those things that just got traction and everyone was weighing in on this argument that there was almost no evidence for whatsoever as far as I could see.
Well, speaking of things that burn, you know what else burns? Valtteri Bottas's butt, because he puts it out in the sun all the time. Valtteri, we love you, man. You are we love watching you race in the Alfa Romeo, leading the team, all the points you've already scored. But stop. Just stop. Please, I'm begging. You're burning my retinas with that white butt all over the place. He was in Aspen, perfect place. Valtteri Bottas in Aspen. Rolling it out there in a stream, naked.
I saw that as well. I was like, oh my gosh, this guy. I mean, you know, he obviously loves his ass and he loves getting it out wherever he goes. The only upside of this whole kind of getting his ass out in Aspen was that it reminded me that my boys are old enough now that I could educate them in the ways of Dumb and Dumber, which is probably one of the best movies of all time.
Yes, agreed.
And you know, they take a road trip to Aspen. So despite the fact that I had to shield my eyes from his butt cheeks, it kind of did, the story ended well because I got to watch Dumb and Dumber with my boys. So there
boy,
we go.
That John Denver is full of beep. Okay. So yeah, and it feels like he has a little tickler in his calendar every 3 months, post naked picture on Instagram. If we could somehow have Paul or somebody delete that from his calendar, that would
be helpful. I'm glad you went there, because I was like, if we could have somehow that have Paul join him and get his ass out as well.
Most certainly no. Paul, if you're listening to this episode, don't join him, please. God, please.
And then the other thing that kind of cropped up this week on a few places, there's something bubbling in the world of F1 at the moment, and it kind of started with the whole jewelry argument, and we touched on it last week, of kind of Lewis being kind of almost like that teenager that sulks by doing the exact opposite of what you've asked them to do. So he turned up to that interview wearing every piece of jewelry known to man. But then the story came up this week that suggested that F1 and the FIA could be looking into parting ways. And I'm like, what? I once saw an episode. Now I can't even remember. What's the one? Not The Simpsons, the space version of The Simpsons with Bender the robot. Come on, what's that? Oh, you've got nothing, have you? Anyway, he basically gets thrown out of a Disneyland park, and he basically says, fine, I'll make my own Disneyland with strippers and blackjack, and just basically, you know, I'm just going to go and do my own thing. And it just kind of felt like that's what F1 are doing at the moment. It's like, we don't like what the FIA are doing, so fine, we're going to make our own racing series up, and screw you. Really? And all these little things just keep bubbling and bubbling and bubbling, like there's just something going on behind the scenes. And what tends to happen in these types of situations, there's a power grab going on somewhere, right?
Oh, I mean, there's a great meme out there that's F1, we race for money. You know, instead of the we race as one, it's we race for money, it's just dollar bills rolling around the little fan. I'll send it out at some point. I thought it was great. So yeah, it's all about money. It's always about money. It's not, as we've said, it's not a non-profit organization.
Yeah, I mean, and that was the thing we touched on last week, I think, where they kind of put the halt on agreeing the extra sprint races, because it's like, oh yeah, well, we've got to look into it more. What I saw this week, which I hadn't realized last week when we were talking about it, was that there's some agreement with the amount of points that can be won in a season seem to translate to some kind of money payment for the FIA. So because sprint races carry an additional point haul, it raises, if you agree extra sprint races, it actually raises the total amount of points that could be won this season. So, ching ching, you know, yeah, we've got to start... Speaking we just want to watch sport.
Speaking of money, why don't you talk about Andretti as well? Because that's also about money.
Well, yeah, I mean, he basically came out and said he's absolutely determined to have his team in by 2024. There seems to be a lot of pushback. Like, again, this kind of splits opinion, that some people think it'll be amazing to get Andretti in and get his team in there, and others are just kind of like, no, it's going to be bad for the whole thing. But I don't know, what do you think about it?
I think it's money. I think if they can find a way to have enough upfront payment, I mean, they should do what North American sports do when they have expansion. You pay an expansion fee, which gets shared primarily amongst the other teams. And so to me, the smart thing to do, and I know there's a big fee they're paying. I don't know who it goes to and how it's shared. But if it's a couple $1 billion or whatever the number is, that should go $200 million. I don't care. $50. It should be split amongst the other teams primarily. And the FIA and F1 should keep their nose out of it, because really the people who it impacts are the other teams. So if F1 wants to take the same cut as the other teams, I guess divide it 11 ways. But that's the way I would do it. I would make that payment. And maybe that is it. I have seen it talked about, but I don't know what they're going to do with it once it's received. So
yeah.
Then have the teams discuss and come to a conclusion on what the right amount is. And if Andretti doesn't want to pay it, then keep it at 10. But that raises the value of the teams as it is. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I've been watching North American sports for too long, but that's NBA's been doing that. Baseball, you know, whenever they thought about contracting or expanding, that was kind of the way they looked at it. And football, you know, when they move teams, there's a relocation fee. All these things should, in my mind, kind of go back to the other teams. But that's just me.
Then I think you had a note in here.
This one was exciting to me.
E-racing, right? Which, you know, I'm not interested. You can take this one.
Well, this one's weird because it's like a mishmash of teams. So the Mercedes EQ Formula E team is going to be sold or shared, I guess, with the McLaren Formula E team is being formed from it. So it'll be a McLaren team, but it's taking over, or through acquisition, the Mercedes Formula E team. And it was really exciting. Zach was real excited about it, and they said further details on the McLaren Formula E team program, including its driver lineup and powertrain, will be announced in due course. But Zach is really pumped about it, and a lot of McLaren fans are really excited about it as well. And I think it's great. I mean, you know, we often talk about where's the driver lineup for teams come from. Where are the junior drivers, right? And we see guys like Piastri and others who are really good in F2, Formula 2, but don't have a ride for whatever reason. They thought they were getting F1 or their seat was given away, and they don't really have anywhere to go. And they're sort of the reserve driver. And it worked fine for Albon. It worked fine for others over the years. But wouldn't it be great if, you know, Formula E and F2 could kind of serve as support feeder series for F1, keeping people sharp and letting them do that? And if you own the team, you know, more opportunities for a driver lineup to build. So to me, I thought it was exciting to watch. I was a little curious about Mercedes kind of getting out and McLaren coming in. But regardless, you know, I'm not the biggest Formula E guy, but I'm excited for it. I hope it really keeps, you know, kind of growing as opposed to shrinking. So seeing McLaren enter, I thought was a good thing.
Yeah, maybe. I don't really follow the Formula E that much, so I kind of, but I agree with you. I think if you can have a better, rather than it becoming a retirement series for people that leave F1 and then go and drive in Formula E, then if it could help develop young drivers coming through, I think that'd be a good thing as well. Just one thing about McLaren is I saw a really good meme that was, a meme of the guy putting a cigar in his mouth and putting swag over his shoulder and kind of strutting out of a building. And the headline said, McLaren leaving Miami, knowing that while they scored no points, their Instagram presence is awesome. I just thought that they've got to be really careful, because that kind of sums McLaren up this year. They seem to be the ones going all out on social. They put the funny stuff up. They've always got Lando and Danny doing something. And they seem at the moment to be thinking that a solid social presence is worth more than points in the Constructors' Championship. And I'm sure they don't think that way, but that's kind of how it does. When I saw that meme, I'm like, yeah, it kind of, that is really summing up McLaren this year at the moment.
Well, Give them some time. They'll be better. There's a lot coming in Spain this coming week in terms of upgrades. I know you have a thought on some of the, what Ferrari may or may not be bringing.
Well, yeah, I saw a story. I always kind of try to read between the lines when you see like the team principals come out. And when they come out and say, we have important upgrades coming ahead of Spain, it's like, what do you mean by important? Important as in something that's going to close the gap to straight line speed to Red Bull, and it's important to do that, or important that you're fixing something that you've screwed up, or yeah, I mean, important can be kind of looked at a number of different ways, and I wish they would just be. I know they can't just come straight out and go, oh yeah, we've got this thing that we're going to add over here, and it's going to make us go faster, because then they give away their secret sauce to everyone else. But this kind of, they're almost covering their you know what when they're kind of saying, oh, it's important. And what was it? Oh, it was better food in the truck.
Mancha.
Come on, just if you think you're going to be closing that straight line speed deficit, then just come out and say it. And if you're not, you're not. But don't just hide behind important. It's just a bit rubbish, really. But the other thing I saw was that Alpine are very upset about Alonso's penalty. And at very first upset. I thought, I kind of looked at this and I thought, oh, here we go, sour grapes, let's just cry about it a bit more. But actually, as I read into it, I was like, ooh, this is actually quite an interesting point, which is that, so he cut across the chicane in Miami and he didn't take a place because he was ahead going in and he stayed ahead. And he backed off knowing that he'd gained an advantage. They were trying to work it out and saying it was probably about 0.6 of a second that he'd gained by cutting the chicane. So he backed off twice. I don't remember this, but apparently he put his hand out of the car almost to acknowledge, hey, I've given time back, radioed into the team to say, do you think I've given enough back? They said yes, and the FIA weren't satisfied, so he got the 5-second stop-go penalty.
Wow.
Not stop-go, it was added on at the end. Now, what Alpine is saying is, how are they measuring this, and why wouldn't they have radioed back? I know they're trying to stop the direct contact, but If Alpine think they've done enough and they've given that time back, and the FIA think it's not quite enough, tell them then. Tell them, sorry, you've got another 0.2 seconds to go. Because as Alpine was saying, when you gain a place, it's super easy to know that you gave it back because
right,
you pull over and you let
the other car.
Exactly, yeah. You pull over and you let the car go past. When you've cut the chicane, A, who measures how much do you actually think you've gained? Again, that'll be arbitrary as to whether it was 0.6, was it 0.55, was it 0.65? Right. You know, what was the exact amount of time gained? And then was that exact amount of time given back again? I can actually see why they're kind of really annoyed about it, really, because Fernando did lift off a couple of times. So what's he supposed to do? Because he can't back off to give the place back because he never took it in the first
place.
But
yeah, I think the FIA is going to have a call from Otmar Schaffschenauer on line two, wanting to talk about that a little more. And speaking of kind of weird penalties and things, we have some breaking research updates here that we want to highlight. And so the first one we're going to look into is last week, Mike Crack filled his fridge with gas. Mike Crack's got gas. And so it was too cold, and everybody in the world at Aston Martin had to start from the pit lane. And so we kind of discussed it, and a few listeners sent us some notes, but I found a really good article from a couple years ago. And during, and I'm just going to read it here effectively, during FP1 in Singapore 2019, FIA sensors noticed the fuel that was ready to go into Lewis Hamilton's car was more than 11 degrees Celsius below the ambient temperature. And the technical regs state that the fuel cannot be more than 10 degrees Celsius lower than the ambient temperature at the start of the session. And as a result, Mercedes was hit with a £5,000 fine. So that's not a ton of money. I don't know why Aston Martin wouldn't have started from the grid and taken a £10,000 fine. To me, I'd much rather pay £10,000 than see my cars start from the pit lane and ruin the race. But who knows if the penalties have changed since then, because this did become a thing. And you may say, well, why would they chill the gas anyway? So first off, when it's chilled, fuel becomes denser. And so for us in regular road cars, it means you get more fuel for your money if you fill it up on a cold day, because there'll be ever so slightly more fuel in a liter or a gallon or whatever your measurement is than a warm one. That's why F1 fuel is measured by weight and not volume. Because 110 kilograms of fuel is 110 kilograms, regardless of how much space it takes up. But that's not really the reason why you chill it. Chilling fuel does offer another benefit, apparently more power. The colder the fuel is, the more of it that gets injected into the combustion chamber of the engine, thus potentially providing an increase in power. That's why the FIA has regulated the temperature to 10 degrees Celsius below the ambient temperature at the start of the session. Otherwise, you'd have teams in there with, you know, basically damn near frozen fuel trying to get as much into the combustion chamber as possible. So, while that was nerdy and boring, I'm sure, that answers, it both gets to the reg, it gets to the reason, and it gets to what happened. I still don't know the penalty, however, and if it was a double 5,000-pound penalty, then I find it ridiculous that Aston Martin couldn't have manned up and just paid $10,000 as opposed to starting in the pit lane. I mean, what would you choose? $10,000 penalty? And I recognize money's not, you know, growing on trees, but come on now, this is Formula One. There's 23 of these races. Don't mess them up.
Yeah, exactly. And given that constructors' points are going to add up to money at the end of the season, then the chances of grabbing some extra points on the board rather than going from the back and getting nothing, then just take the gamble. Unless it's one of those things that's so unclear that they had no idea what the penalty was going to be, so they like, we don't want to get DQ'd before we even start. So,
had me on the team, I would have Googled it right in real time and told them, well, in 2019 it was $5,000. But anyway.
Yeah, but then the problem would have been, though, the problem would be because they wouldn't have even started, because if you'd have been stood in the pit lane going, blah, 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 sounding like the Charlie Brown teacher, both the drivers would have fallen asleep and not even made the start line.
Yeah, that's a real risk. Thanks for being so nice as I now enter a question for you, buddy. All right, in 2022 so far, who do you think has had the most overtakes, the most positions gained? And I recognize this stat is a little bit of bunk, because if you start near the front, it's harder to do an overtake and you have less opportunities for them, meaning, you know, it's a different race. If you start in the back, you know, there's more chance to overtake. So I'm not trying to say it's the best stat ever, but so far, and they even made that a dumb award last year, if you remember, most overtakes, Seb won. He goes, what do we get, a trinket? And so here it is, 2022, so far, who has the most overtakes in F1?
So, unlapping on the safety car doesn't count as overtakes, right?
No, it does not.
You can't. Okay, cool.
Positions gained. Positions
somebody
gained.
Somebody near the back who was Ocon.
Come on, man. Ocon's third. That's not a bad guess. He's third. Okay. But who is so high in the power rankings, out of place for the car he drives?
Okay, Albon.
Albon. 27 overtakes so far. And you nailed third with Ocon.
So who's in second? K-Mac?
No. This one's actually a little bit more surprising and a little bit more exciting to me, because it is a front-running team. May I give you the answer? Or
you may. Think, you know, you may. Give me the answer.
Or can we just fill the rest of the podcast with silence?
Just silence for the next 20 minutes.
George F. Russell. Second most positions gained in
that's
the tracks.
That's an unfair stat, because we've never seen him on TV yet this season.
Yeah, correct. Because he's in witness protection.
We wouldn't know how many times he's overtaken anybody. In fact, I don't even believe he's actually been in a race yet.
He just shows up at the end.
Like, yeah, they just give him a report. Yeah, you finished fifth. Well done, George.
It's the Boston Marathon lady, Rosie whatever, who just took a train halfway and then sprayed herself. Woo, I'm really tired.
Exactly.
23 overtakes. So pretty impressive. And you know, speaking of people starting near the back, not George, but some of the other components, I just got to highlight this. I'm sorry. It was a mistake someone made. People make mistakes. But a guy named Norris McDonald on Twitter, he's got a blue check, announced to the world that Nicholas Latifi was being fired from Williams and they were bringing in Nick DeVries. And he sent this out to the world, and then he sent out about 5 minutes later, correction, Nick Latifi will continue as a Williams driver for the foreseeable future. Information I received earlier today was incorrect. But it set off a Twitter storm unlike anything I'd seen. It was wild. I thought Nicky Latifi was gone, and then it turns out this gentleman, Norris McDonald, which I think might be a fake name. It's Lando Norris goes to McDonald's. It was all just all wrong. And you know, one last note just from kind of thinking through stuff that's going on that I wanted to highlight real quick is obviously the rise of Formula One. That's why we're doing this podcast. But we've been long been fans, but we felt there were people who wanted to participate, and it's no longer like the best kept secret and people are watching. But JJ Watt, so for NFL fans and here in America, he's now on the Cardinals, long time with the Texans. Cardinals are Arizona, Rob. That's not the St. Louis Cardinals, different sports. And so he's a huge F1 fan. He and his brother TJ Watt, Pittsburgh Steelers. Pittsburgh Steelers, Rob. They play football. And so
they have Big Ben. I know that.
Not anymore.
Well, not anymore. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Almost. You're very close.
Thank you.
Half a point. And so so he is a huge fan of Haas, and in particular Gunther Steiner. And he actually he was in Miami. He and his brother TJ were actually changing wheels, giving it a try in the Haas garage. We didn't see him on the gridwalk, that infamous Martin Brundle disaster. But it was awesome to hear and read about, you know, a guy like JJ Watt, who has achieved so much in his sport, being a fanboy of both, you know, Gunther, the Haas team, and Formula One as a whole. It's fun to watch kind of our thing that we all, you know, the listeners have loved or are new to spread, and just exciting. So the last thing I had before we get into Fangio is, Rob, let's talk a little bit about contracts. I was shocked by this. I looked a little bit at driver contracts, and there are 20 drivers on the grid. 11 of them have contracts that go beyond this year. So that, to me, is already curious. Interesting. There are 9 drivers who are done at the end of this year on their current contract, or in Lance Stroll's case, unknown. But that means there could be a lot of changes come the end of this year. Now, some of them I don't think will go anywhere. Checo's contract is done at the end of this year. I would think he'd stay. You know, Albon's contract's done at the end of this year. I would assume he'd stay. Mick, I would assume Haas would continue to invest in. But then there are folks like Yuki and Fernando, who's obviously doing really well, but is he going to want to stay? Seb, Zhou, rookie year, will they keep him around? Latifi's contract's done end of this year. I mean, there's a lot of questions, I think, that in not too long will start getting solved. I mean, it's one of those things, I've pointed it out on the pod before, it's very different from North American sports where people announce their next team halfway into the year.
Yeah, we will get into the silly season soon where all those kind of rumors start coming out. Because when you look at, you know, even if Checo, for some reason, Red Bull didn't re-sign him, someone will. There's no chance that he drops out of Formula One, although we can probably crop that little statement out if he does leave and we can play that back and show how wrong I was. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, and we will come to silly season where everyone starts looking to shuffle the pack. But it's... I still find it bizarre. No matter, even though I've watched this sport for so long, it is a weird one. I don't really understand why they kind of do it in the middle of the year. I'm sure it wasn't. I'm sure it wasn't like that back in Fangio's day. So
certainly wasn't.
So here's a nice little segue. I'm going to hand this over to Brian in a second because he's done a huge amount of research into this. So we wanted to do Fangio because every single time a conversation comes up about who's the greatest of all time. Or even not even necessarily that, when someone is even just holding somebody up to judge how good they are, this guy's name always comes up. He's always kind of the yardstick everybody is measured against. Oh, is he better than Fangio, though? So a lot of people know his name. They know the 5 world championships, and they know that he was just amazing. And then when you go to scratch beneath the surface, there's a lot that isn't known about him. So we wanted to dive in this week, and specifically Brian wanted to dive in this week and kind of started peeling back the layers of kind of what makes everyone talk about Fangio in those kind of those terms. So over to you, Brian.
Thanks, Rob. I feel like there should be a fire and a glass of wine, and we should sit down on a nice rug and discuss.
I've got a beer.
Yeah, me too. Or Coors Light, I call it a beer. Most people call it water. So Juan Manuel Fangio, born in 1911. He had a couple of different nicknames. El Chueco, the bow-legged one, because of the way he would bend the ball in soccer, apparently. El Maestro, for soccer. El Maestro, the master, which is most people know him as a nickname as El Maestro. So he was born in Argentina, and you got to put yourselves back in time a little bit. Right, 1911, Formula One officially started as an ongoing entity in 1950. Okay, that's 39 years before F1 was really started. So, you know, in my mind, you kind of have to shift yourself back in time a little bit and think about the fact that he's looking at cars and driving cars. Cars were relatively new at this point. I mean, this is a completely different world. At the age of 11 or 12, he went to work in a garage, and I say 11 or 12 because a couple articles I read said 11, a couple articles I read said 12. He went to work in a garage. And what's cool to me is Fangio learned cars from the mechanical side, right? You may say, well, what does that mean? There are a lot of drivers who learn to drive by driving. Fangio really got the feel and the knowledge of cars from the mechanical side, and that's where he started. He was actually a mechanic in races. He would be kind of the co-driver for people. At 17, he rode along as a mechanic in a race, and he just kind of got into this way of he was a car guy who got into driving, and he realized he was good. At the age of 21, he was served his mandatory Argentine service in the military. And one of his superiors in the military saw him drive, and not like in a race driving, but just driving around, and realized he had game. And so this person appointed Fangio his official driver. And so that was his job. One of his jobs in the military in Argentina in 1932, when he was 21 years old, was driving, you know, his senior officer around, because the officer knew he was amazing. And at this point, when he leaves the military in a couple years, he says, you know what, I really want to get into cars. I loved it. I love driving. I really think there's something here. He opened his own garage. He raced in local events. And again, this is my point. You got to go back in time to think about what he's driving. In 1936, he began his racing career in Argentina. 1936, he's already 25 years old. Okay, that's older than a lot of the F1 drivers today who have been karting forever. So it's a different world. And this guy with all this talent starts to put it together and realize what he's going to do. He rebuilt a 1929 Ford Model A. I mean, this is not a race car, right? And so you see these things, you know, they're cranking them on the front and you'd rather ride a horse. He's turning these things into race cars. He's out there. It is awesome to think about what he did to get started in this thing.
And I think that's why when you see certain drivers, they'll make those parallels back to Fangio. And there's not too many of them. I would say Lauda, Schumacher, ones where they say drivers that got to grips with understanding the mechanics, the mechanical aspect of it. Because the most frustrating thing for the team is if you drive and you go around a circuit and you come back in and say, yeah, we're losing time. And the crew say, well, you know, why are we losing time? Oh, yeah, car's not fast enough. It doesn't help the guys in the garage at all understand what's going on. Whereas, you know, the Schumachers, the Laudas, and Fangios are able to come in and give pinpoint exact places on the car that they feel are loose or a slip in, a lack of grip or what have you. And I think those drivers that really understand the mechanics of a car tend to become the great ones, right?
Agreed, 100%. We actually, there's a story later about how he loved to sit with the team. He was never above anybody. He's a gentle man, they said, and I put a space in there. Not a gentleman, I mean a gentle man, a kind person who used to love to work with the team on the mechanics, like you said. And so, agreed, you know, in Rush, you saw Lauda, and he said that was accurate, where he says, you know, I have a fantastic ass, because he could feel the car underneath him, and he knew what to fix. And so Fangio grew up on that mechanical side, and to me, that was pretty interesting. And he started running in the 1940s, at the time of the Second World War. Again, we've got to remember what's happening at this point. Literally, the world is at war, and he's in Argentina running Chevys in the Grand Prix International Championships. He devoted his time to the Argentine Turismo Carretera. He was the champion twice over in this session. But I would say there were two big stories three, we'll get to the last part, but two accidents that really marked changes in Fangio's life. And the first one happened right here, 1948. He's still not on the world stage. He was doing a grueling 20-day race from Buenos Aires to Caracas, Venezuela. And he had a co-driver with him, Daniel Urrutia. And they were battling a bunch of teams. Again, 20 days, long race, 6,000 miles. And they're on their way. And on the 10th day, in northern Peru, they ran into some fog, heavy, thick fog near the ocean. It was near pitch black darkness. He approached a left-hander at, according to witnesses and people who have put it back together, about 90 miles an hour in 1940s cars, okay? And so with the car's lights not helping, they lost control, tumbled down an embankment, and his co-driver was thrown out of the car through the front windscreen. The competitors saw this. They came upon him after a bit. Found Fangio, found the co-driver, Eurytia, and they brought them to hospital, but it was too late for the co-driver. He passed. And Fangio did survive. It was a horrible accident, a horrible disaster. The race itself, not just this accident, but the race itself, three people died and three drivers died, one of them being the co-driver with Fangio. At this point, 48, right? 1948. Fangio is what, 37 years old? He's raced around Argentina. He's had this horrible accident. He kind of gets, according to a couple of the different articles I read and even a video that I saw, he got a little depressed at this point and thinking, you know, this is just not, maybe this isn't my bag. This is a dangerous thing. I lost a friend. And it weighed on him heavily. However, his prior success had actually been noticed by the government and the Argentine Automobile Club and the Juan Perón. They noticed this and they said, we're going to get you a Maserati and we want to send you to Europe to represent Argentina. And so in 48, he went over to Europe to start racing in a lot of the precursor races to Formula One and kind of continue his career. And it was just, it was amazing the ups and downs of the year of his 37th year of life for Juan Fangio. It was just amazing what he kind of did there.
Yeah, I mean, and then he kind of came over and had amazing success. So he comes over. Like you say, it's the year before F1 is going to start, so it's 1949. He won the opening race of the European season and won seven races in that year. Two other drivers, one being Ascari, joined him on that. So he came over and kind of hit the ground running, had great success as soon as he got here. And then 1950 rolls around and F1 joins. So he decides to join F1 at the nice young age of 39, which is
39.
Just... when you wrote that, I could see your notes in here. I was like, no, that can't be right. He's got a typo there. It's got to be 29. It's, but no, 39 years old, he makes his debut in Formula One in the Alfa Romeo. Just insane.
You know what was interesting as well? Obviously, everyone's a rookie in 1950. That's the first year of Formula One. But 39, you're right. But there were other older drivers. There were drivers older than Fangio. And this is where, in the 50s, that Prince you mentioned in our one-on-one game came in. So some people viewed Formula One as a kind of rich, you know, playboy-type sport. Fangio, the OG of drivers, the professional, the mechanic, he viewed it as a profession, meaning he took it seriously. There are stories he loved to have fun, go out and party, but before races and race sessions, he famously buttoned it up, focused on the craft, worked with the team. He was the OG professional, and that is why I think he's so special. In an era when Formula One was 5 years post-World War II, right? Launched in Europe in just a crazy time, with cars that aren't nearly as safe, not safe at all. They didn't have seatbelts. We'll get to that more in a second here. Just amazing to watch Fangio, the OG. This guy is amazing. So as you said, at 50, he joined Formula One. He ran for Alfa Romeo. He won three of the races, but he lost the championship by just 3 points to his teammate, Giuseppe Farina. So Farina is the first F1 champion in 1950. However, Fangio says, you know what? It's my turn next. And so he wins the 1952 World Championship. Sorry, excuse me, 1951 World Championship in the Alfa Romeo. And then in one of the craziest turn of events that you're going to see, in 1952, they changed the specifications, Formula One did. And they were running sort of what they called at the time Formula 2 specs. And Alfa Romeo didn't have a car. And so the world champion, the 1951 world champion, Fangio, has no car in 1952 because Alfa Romeo doesn't have anything for him. And so, as a result, he found himself without a car. He kind of drove this British BRM for a bit in non-championship races. But it really wasn't until sort of the end of 52 where he got an opportunity to get back in, as I said, in that car. However, this is kind of where the second accident comes into play in Fangio's life. There were others, but these are the ones that I noted as being big. Fangio had agreed to drive for Maserati in a non-championship race at Monza. But he missed a flight, a connecting flight, and he decided to drive through the night on pre-motorway mountain roads from Lyon to the race at Monza. He arrived at Monza, this is 1952, he arrived at Monza at 2 p.m., badly fatigued with the race starting in 30 minutes. He drove overnight and said, I'll just rock up and get in the car. He started the race from the back, And then here's where he lost control on the second lap, crashed into a grass bank, was thrown out of the car because, again, hello, no seatbelts. And it flipped end over end, smashed through trees. He was taken to a hospital in Milan with multiple injuries, the most serious being a broken neck.
That's just a flesh wound.
Exactly, just a little, just rub some dirt on it. Spent the rest of 1952 recovering back in Argentina. Oh my God. So he just 4 years prior, he'd had this, you know, long road race in Argentina where, you know, throughout South America where he'd had an accident. And then 4 years later, his third year at trying to get back into Formula One after winning the championship in 51, 52, no car, you know, has this opportunity. He's like, I can't miss my chance. Drives all night and then has this horrible accident. And so it was just it was a chance for him to rest, recover, and get back at it after that.
Yeah, and then he comes back. So he misses, that was 52, right? So he misses 53, comes back 54. Again, he's into his 40s now, so it's probably going to be just like, ease myself back in and see how things go, or maybe join Mercedes and win the championship. Yeah, let's do that. And then let's win it again in 55. Yeah, okay.
I love that Mercedes. We're going to come back to that. So that car is so cool looking. We'll talk more about it in a second. I found a video that I'll tweet out as well, but that Mercedes, Rob, that 54-55 Mercedes that he won two titles in a row in, so much different looking than a lot of the other cars, which looked like, I don't know, like a kind of like a coffin, right? With a top, round, long, cigar-like car.
I was going to say an upside-down bathtub, but upside coffin, down I mean, bathtub. Let's go coffin.
I don't know. But the Mercedes was flat and like the width of a car with only one little spot to sit in and just had a flat top. Those things were baller. And he won 2 years in a row there. But Fangio being Fangio and this being a sport where people were trying to find the best drivers to put in the best cars, Ferrari wooed him away from Mercedes. And in 56, he won the title with Ferrari. And Fangio's like, you know what? Yeah, I'm going to win a fifth on the trot. 57 goes to Maserati, wins one there. And there was the chassis was made by someone else, but it was considered a Maserati. So in 57, Fangio wins his fifth title with his fourth constructor. And F1's only been a going thing since 1950. So it is just amazing. And there's a video. I'll definitely send this out. It's an onboard video of 57 of him testing the Maserati. It is so cool. It is so awesome. First of all, I don't know how they did it. Like, how big were the cameras? I thought the cameras then were humongous in the late 50s, so I don't know how they taped this thing to the car, but okay. It is epic. First of all, he has his helmet on, which looks like a constructor worker's helmet. Like, you'd go to a job site and slap something on. That's what he did. That was what it was. I don't know what the purpose of that was, to get the bugs out of your hair. Nothing else is going to help. He had goggles on. And he starts going, and he puts them on as he's going, and that's it. There's no seatbelt. It's just insane. And so it's this video of him in this Maserati. He's on a track with bumpy tarmac. I mean, I don't even think I'd like to drive my car on this road. And he's flying around this thing with bicycle tires on the side of his little upside-down bathtub, power sliding it around almost every corner. I'm watching this thing. It's making me pucker up. And it's a 1957 video. What in the actual heck is going on in this thing? So I will make sure that gets sent out here because that is an epic video.
It was. I took a look at that as well, and it's really worth a watch. So keep an eye on the Twitterverse when Brian sends this out.
It was, you know, one other note just here, getting into old cars. This week, Charles obviously had a little situation in Lauda's car. We'll talk a little bit about that here in a second. But prior to that, Formula One had released a video of Charles in Gilles Villeneuve's car. And we talked about Gilles last week, so I just wanted to highlight this. If you haven't seen it, it's a great opportunity to watch Charles bombing around in Gilles Villeneuve's car. It is awesome. However, the reason I highlight this is in Villeneuve's car, you can see the sidewalls of the car flexing, like in the cockpit, as he's driving around. And that's post Fangio. So, like, I don't understand why you would. I mean, you had to have massive cojones to drive these things. And I mentioned the Mercedes. I'll send this out too. Sky Sports in 2019 did a video with Lewis and Martin Brundle in Fangio's Mercedes from the 54-55 season. And Martin went out in it first. And then we had Lewis go out in it. And they loved it. They're like, this was the greatest thing he'd ever seen. So I'll send those videos out. The old cars, I really, to be honest, I'd never been into the 50s kind of Formula One cars. So cool, though, to watch these videos. So we'll see Fangio's on board from the Maserati test in 57 before he started with them. And I'll send out the Brundle Hamilton item as they went around in the 54, 55 Mercedes of Fangio's.
Yeah, so to close out that 57 season, as we said, he won his fifth title in 57. I think there's the one thing that kind of stands out in there is the German Grand Prix, where he's going into the race leading the standings. This is for the championship, and he's got a 30-second lead, so he's breaking out the cigar, the goggles are off, and he's just kind of feet on the dashboard and just coasting around. But then good old pit stops, like they have to every driver of every era. Pit stop screws it all up, and he's now 50 seconds behind the Ferraris of Mike Hawthorn and Peter Collins. So he's got 10 laps left. So Fangio being Fangio, 50 seconds, 10 laps to go. Oh, well, let's just coast home to third, shall we, and just take it. Is that what happened, Brian?
No. Why is he so great? Not just for all the titles. Fangio said, you know what? I'm going to break the lap record at the Nürburgring, but I'm not going to break it once. I'm going to break it 9 times in a row. 9 times, Ferris Bueller. 9. So the 1956 season at the Nürburgring, the lap record was set then by Fangio. 9 minutes, 41 seconds. Okay? So just for everyone's benefit, 9 minutes, 41 seconds. Then, in 1957, in the race Rob just talked about, he decided to break that lap record 9 times in the last 10 laps to win, and win his fifth world title, win the race. But here's what the lap record was at the end of the race. 9 minutes and 17 seconds. That is a gulf, an epic gulf, and he just kept slicing it 9 times out of 10, faster, faster, faster. This guy had talent just oozing everywhere. Amazing. So, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was gonna say, and then things get like real crazy. Everything wasn't crazy enough, 1958 rolls around, and he's at the Cuban Grand Prix, and there's no accident or lap record or anything going on here. He got kidnapped.
Yeah, kidnapped. I mean, So I said there were kind of three main, huge points around an epic F1 career by an older person, if you will, but a professional. This is the third of them, the two accidents that we highlighted already that Rob and I talked about. But in 1958 at the Cuban Grand Prix, the night before the race, Fangio was kidnapped at gunpoint by the Cuban rebels, who were led by none other than Fidel Castro. So I did not know Castro had a kind of piece of this. But so Castro's rebels, trying to gain notoriety for their cause, whatever their cause may be, kidnapped him. And so just a little backstory about Cuba at the time, because I also did some research here to figure out why this was important. President Batista in 53 decided to build Havana into like a Vegas of the Caribbean. There was some organized crime involved. They built casinos, bars, nightlife, but they needed to bring people in. They needed people to want to come. So hosting F1 races and Grand Prix was their decision. They hosted the first F1 Grand Prix in 1957. Fangio won it. In his championship season there. It was a non-championship event. And the second place driver behind Fangio in 57 at the Cuba Grand Prix, none other than Carroll Shelby. I mean, like, the way this all comes together, like, this couldn't have been written. Like, I'm surprised if this isn't a full-on movie. I don't mean a documentary, a full-on movie. So come back to 58, night before the race. He's taken by gunpoints under Castro's folks. Batista, the president, says, you know what, we're running the race. We're not going to negotiate with terrorists, or however you want to phrase it. They're running the race. So he sent some police out to look for Fangio. In that race, a Ferrari, and I can't remember who drove it at this point, crashed. Lost control, crashed. 30 spectators were injured. 7 were killed. Now, Sterling Moss won this race. And as the race concluded, Fangio was delivered back the next day, effectively, to the Argentine embassy. It was embarrassing for Batista. It helped the rebels' cause. And yes, Castro was president by the end of that year. Did this help? Probably. Fangio, after all this, and now he's getting up in age, retired from motorsport 5 months later. What an epic sort of tie. Castro and, the Fangio, and the fact that it all kind of came together, and you're racing Sterling Moss and Carroll Shelby, and it's... The thing that I took from this that was the most bizarre, and you could see old magazine articles, is one of his kidnappers, Arnold Rodriguez, became friends with Fangio. It is said, now this part we can read into, and I'm not going to try to proffer an opinion, but it's said that Fangio sympathized with the rebels, and either through Stockholm Syndrome or actually agreeing with them, he became friends with his kidnapper, Arnold Rodriguez, and Rodriguez came to visit Fangio in Argentina shortly before he died in 1995. So for the 29 hours that Fangio was kidnapped, either, according to Fangio, it was a big nothing burger, and I was fine, or it was very serious and scary, and he bonded with his kidnappers. Regardless, just the craziest situation and the way it happened. And 5 months later, he's never raced again. I mean, he did some, you know, retiree races for fun and giggles, but that was the end of his career, effectively, that season, 58.
Yeah, it's just such an action-packed, like, you go from, like, the dawn of Formula One, from 50 through to when he retires, and he was just... It's just what he did, the way he went about it, the equipment in those days. And I think, you know, looking at some of the other things that he would do, which you've seen current drivers do, you saw Schumacher do it, is the whole thing around, apparently he had a habit of going around the track on a bike or a motorcycle to learn the track and kind of work out all of the strategies for the race day. And as you mentioned earlier, got personally involved in all of the car setup, making sure that he was given the exact information to the race engineers to help them make the tweaks to the cars that would be needed to be made, not just tell them make it go faster. So whether that's just in the DNA of these certain types of drivers, or whether those types of drivers are just holding Fangio up in just such esteem that in order to be Fangio, you need to be that way. You need to be mechanically minded. You need to be part of the team. It's not just you as the driver and then those other kind of lowlifes over there. It's it's absolutely amazing. And I think where it said that he died in 1995, aged 84. And Jackie Stewart is now the last survivor of the six pallbearers. You put that note in there. I was like, oh wow. And then, do you want to go through who the other people were that were carrying the coffin?
In addition, before we get to that, I would highlight one thing. It's so amazing that, you know, you look at the people he respected and loved in the race. And so Stirling Moss, I would just highlight this, in 55 at the British Grand Prix, he was leading in the last lap, and out of camera at some point, he was leading, and Stirling Moss came ahead to win by 0.2. No one knows exactly what happened, but Stirling Moss actually believed that Fangio let him win his home race because he loved these guys. So Jackie Stewart, Stirling Moss, Carlos Reitemann, all those guys were pallbearers at his funeral in 95. He died on July 17th. July 17th is now the anniversary of his death, is the day of motor racing in Argentina. It's epic. There's six statues of him put up around the world, made by Catalan artist Joaquim Ros Sabate in Buenos Aires, and Monaco, in Spain, at the Nürburgring, in Stuttgart, and in Monza. And so it is, you know, you may say that's just tremendous, and you may say, well, why, you know, what else would make him the best? Well, guess what? We happen to have some more SAP stats on that. SAP stats, Fangio edition. And so, as we already said, five world champions for four constructors. We already talked about Alfa Romeo, Maserati, Mercedes, Ferrari. He has the highest win percentage in F1 history. He's won 47% of the races he entered, 24 wins out of 52. He had 29 poles, 23 fastest laps. He had 35 podiums, which is 68%. So 7 out of 10 races, he ended up on the podium. 9 hat tricks, 2 grand slams. And if that isn't enough, there was a university study done, Formula for Success, Multi-Level Modeling of Formula One Driver and Constructor Performance. While that may sound like a boring title, to me that sounded exciting. I'm just going to cut to the answer. They did a reduction on taking out team and the performance of the driver, taking out weather and the performance of the driver, taking out a variety of things. And they try to just isolate the driver and their result versus expected result. And the number one driver in the history of Formula One is Juan Manuel Fangio, according to this article. Number two is Alain Prost. Three is Michael Schumacher, but up to 2006, so not the Mercedes comeback. It actually brings him down a little in the standings. Jim Clark, fourth. Senna, fifth. Fernando Alonso 6th, Nelson Piquet 7th, Jackie Stewart 8th, Emerson Fittipaldi 9th, and Sebastian Vettel 10th. Now, this paper obviously was written a few years ago, so I don't know if his time at the end of Ferrari and Aston Martin would hurt that. Hamilton, by the way, is 12th, for anyone curious, in this paper. So, man, just amazing. There's last thing I'll say on Fangio is there's a documentary, A Life of Speed, on Netflix. I haven't had a chance to watch it all, so I will watch it over the next couple weeks, I know, because I'm just so intrigued and amazed. But I would say he's the OG. He's a professional. He understood the car. He was a kind gentleman. And he just had a crazy life when you kind of listen to the accidents and the kidnapping.
Yeah, and the kidnapping. Just kind of just throw that in at the end there. So, yeah, absolutely mental. But back to the current time, and we are now looking forward to a race in Spain. It's going to be held in Barcelona, but the track's not actually in Barcelona, so they call it the Barcelona Grand Prix, but it's not actually in Barcelona, but never mind. It's a relatively new track, built in 91, and a number of different one of a number of different tracks that go under the Spanish GP title. One of the big problems with Spain is that over the years it's given us, let's just be honest, it's given us pretty boring results. And one of the big criticisms that's leveled at it is that because the vast majority of the testing gets done there, the teams and the drivers are just so familiar with the whole thing that it's it kind of impacts the on-track action. So they haven't been great down the years. It's had some moments. We've had Senna versus Mansell in 91. I'd go onto YouTube and find that video, them going wheel to wheel down the straight. It's fantastic. Schumacher ruled in the rain in 96, because apparently the rain in Spain falls mainly on the track. and in 2006, Alonso became the first Spanish driver to win there. But as you can see there, there are a few smatterings of highlights over many, many, many years. But there might be some good news coming. So I was watching a video on YouTube by a guy called Chain Bear, and he was doing a dive into why is Spain a track that doesn't tend to give us good racing. And he basically said, on face value, if you look at it, we've got straights, we've got DRS, we've got a mix of high-speed corners, medium-speed corners, and a couple of heavy braking zones. So why doesn't it all thread together? And it's because of the sequencing, he says, according to his view. It's the sequencing of the DRS zones come after high-speed corners. And the high-speed corners are where the dirty air that's being thrown off the back of the car has got the biggest impact to the car following behind. They're hitting that dirty air, they're losing downforce on the front wing, so it tends to lead to understeer, which means they need to back off a little bit to bite back in again and be able to take that corner. Which what that has led to is that no one's close enough going into those two DRS zones to really do anything other than gobble up the time gap in between and get back down to being within 0.2, but not get into a position for a pass. So, the veil optimism, the glass half full view from, I'm going to throw this over to Brian to see what he thinks, is that with these new regs, if we have bigger reliance on ground effect now, will those high speed corners be able to be taken at a higher speed and allow those cars to get closer and actually use the DRS zones to make a pass rather than just get close? Is it deluded optimism, Brian, or do you think there's something to this?
I really hope it's true. I hope that for the sake of the event next week, I hope it's true. I'm not betting everything on it, although I am betting on it. Lewis was a 40-1 long shot, and Mercedes is supposed to have some upgrades coming through. So did I put $20 on Lewis to win? Yes. Did I probably just donate $20 to DraftKings or whomever? Probably. But I'm hoping for an interesting race all around.
Yeah, I think if they can, we just get some of that closer racing that we've seen. Given where the DRS zones are, then I don't think we'll end up with a DRS train so much. But who knows? Who knows? But that's all coming next week. So need to make sure that we get our fantasy picks in come midweek. But I think we've got a little something coming up right now, haven't we, Brian?
All right, everybody, we are super excited for the 100 Seconds of DRS this week. We have listener Steve with us, and Steve, this is an amazing story. You were at the Miami GP last week, correct?
Hey, guys, how's it going? Yep, I was in the hot, blistering, humid sun of Miami last week, but it was awesome. It was worth it.
Well, thanks for joining us here on the 100 Seconds. Sorry, Rob, I just want to ask, I mean, you're wearing a hat. I know the listeners can't see this. You're wearing a Mercedes hat. Is that an $80 Mercedes hat?
Yes, sir. It is the infamous $80 Mercedes hat. It was their cheapest hat too. They went up to $130, but you know, it's a good, solid, high quality hat that, you know, I'll have the memories forever. But it was worth it too to get out of the sun because I didn't have a hat that I brought with me. So it hurt. It hurt so bad to buy it, but it was worth it.
Yeah, but like you said, you know, when we were chatting before we started recording, you go to anything like this, music concert, Disneyland, wherever you go, you're going to pay for the merch. So yep. It doesn't sound actually as horrific as I thought it might do. And one thing is, we were just kind of talking beforehand, was there was some unfair criticism, or we didn't know if it was unfair because myself and Brian couldn't get along to the GP. And a lot of people saying that away from the glamour and the glitz of the celebs, the whole thing was like the Fyre Festival. And you kind of took exception to that when we were chatting earlier. So it'd be cool if you could give the, you said it, the normal person's view of the Grand Prix, right?
Yeah, I definitely think that the Fyre Fest comment is very unfair. Like, everything was set up great. There were no incidents that I saw. I was there all 3 days. I mean, we walked around the whole track. Like, there were no crazy accidents or anything like that. The food was great. The food was there. There was plenty of, you know, they were porta potties, but there were plenty of them. There was no lines backing up. It was great, man. Everyone seemed to be having a good time. There was no crazy incidents where you thought like, oh man, they did not plan for this well or anything. And again, this was just where all the mass of people were walking around, going over the bridges, going, getting drinks, water and everything. Everything was set up, coordinated well. The people that were working there knew where everything was. So it was actually pretty legit. And so I can't even imagine the VIP suite section, how nice that was. But yeah, even just for the general people, like I thought they did a great job. And yeah, definitely not Fyre Fest. I will say that was a worry going in. I was telling my wife, I was like, what if this is like Fyre Fest and we're walking in and they're going to run out of water. It's going to be like 95 degrees and we're just dying out there. But that wasn't the case at all. I thought they did a brilliant job for the first time ever doing it too.
Yeah. Well, then the race started. Tell us a little bit about, you know, if we cut right to Sunday, tell us a little bit about your race experience as well, watching that.
Oh, man, it was awesome. So we were sitting turn 18 and we got lucky too, cause they had one of the big screens like right in front of where we were sitting too. So we were able to like, you know, kind of follow the race the whole time, but yeah, man, when lights out go and everyone's just standing up and you see, you know, Charles go in front first and those first, you know, few laps of them being right next to each other, him and Max, just every time. And of course there were plenty of Dutch fans sitting next to me, which was, they were well-behaved, but I still didn't love them. But, you know, so every time, you know, Max and Charles would drive by, everyone's standing up because you can hear them. On the previous turns, you can hear the cars and the roar start coming. So you say, okay, they're coming. And so everyone's just getting so hyped up for them to make that turn, that last turn into turn 18, and then drive right in front of you. And so, yeah, that was an awesome experience. And then, you know, just to kind of follow what was happening. And then an interesting like element of it was where we were sitting, you look up and there's these huge dark clouds and you're just like, okay, because before the race started, there was a few moments of downpour. And you're thinking, okay, it looks like it's coming. When's that rain coming? And it's just going to change everything. And of course, it never did, which was, you know, a little frustrating because everyone's looking up, looking at the sky, to waiting to see if that rain's coming. But it never did. So there was always just those few little things that you're like, okay, I'm sure there's going to be a safety car. There might be rain. Like, so just that whole anticipation. And then, you know, next thing you know, it's the last lap, and you're just like, oh. I guess it's over, and then it's over, and then you're like, okay, all that, and then I guess we'll just head out. So.
I'm just wondering awesome. As well, when you saw the dark clouds coming, did the Mercedes merchandise guy come out with the $150 umbrellas?
Right. If he did, he probably would have suckered me, and I probably would have bought one. But
$150, really giving it away for half price? I mean, come on.
Right.
So, Steve, I guess one last question on the GP. You know, for people who have never been, myself included, to a race, you know, would you recommend going? Did you have a good time? Are you planning, maybe not for next year or whenever it is, but going back again, just in general, in summary, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, how do you look at it?
Two thumbs up. I definitely think it's for a race fan, it's like, you know, it's a bucket list thing you got to do, you know, whether it's in the US or, you know, you go to Canada or Mexico or something like that. Like, just the experience, like on Friday when we were walking in, just that first time hearing those engines in person, I was just kind of, me and my wife just looked at each other like, wow, this is really happening. Like, just that first moment of hearing it is so worth it. And just the race itself is awesome. Like, you know, obviously there's a lot of like planning beforehand, like, and I love planning, so I enjoy doing it, but, you know, making sure you know where to go, you know where to stay. Like, there's a lot of, it's such a big event. There's so many elements that, you know, kind of go into it. And obviously, you know, the cost is a lot too, but I think it's absolutely a bucket list thing you have to do, because it just is, it's so different than on TV. And I mean, like any sporting thing, but like, you know, I've been to basketball, football, soccer, you know, whatever. There's nothing like it. Like, that was insane. Just like hearing those cards for the first time, it was really cool.
I'm so jealous. It's ridiculous. I'm almost ready to hang up on you now, because
amazing. Steve, thanks for that recap, and thanks for sort of the, you know, fans' view of the race, and we really appreciate that. So, now it's amazing for you. 1 week you get to go to the GP, and the next weekend you get to do the 100 seconds of DRS. I mean, could it be any better?
I'm sweating, man. I've listened to a few before, and so I've been thinking of questions in my head, and I'm just like, okay, hopefully I don't just like stall out and just like completely fizzle. So let's see.
Well, it's okay. If you don't like one of them, you can just say pass, and we will only make a little bit of fun of you afterwards. So that's, that's totally fine as well. So if you're ready, are you ready?
Yep.
I am ready. I'll be giving the questions this week. Rob, are you ready with the timer, which is always a snafu for us? Are you ready with that job?
I am, and I'm on a, just like the fantasy stuff, I'm on a streak now, because the one we recorded the other day went well. I nailed it, 100 seconds dead on, so
exactly.
The only way is down, baby.
Remember, it's 1 minute and 40 seconds.
I've got it down.
60 seconds plus 40 seconds, 100 seconds. I'm just...
Oh, man, right.
Yeah, right, yep.
Okay, I'm going to count you guys in then. So here we go for 100 seconds of DRS in 3, 2, 1...
Steve, the first poster you had on your bedroom wall?
I think it was probably Eddie Van Halen.
Nice. What's your favorite restaurant?
Ooh, let's see. I am partial to... Oh, boy. So you guys are killing me already. I'll say Capital Grille. I went there in Miami. It was awesome.
Love it. Great place. Who's the best young driver in F1?
Lando Norris.
Who is your favorite driver in F1 currently?
Lewis Hamilton.
Love it. Cats or dogs?
Both. I have both and I love both.
Oh, well, there you go. Is it pronounced GIF or JIF?
GIF.
Absolutely. Yes, you are correct. Is a hot dog a sandwich?
Absolutely not.
What's your favorite non-motorsport sport?
Basketball.
Love it. What's your first memory of F1?
Let's see. Well, it's the reason I got into F1 was reading about it in a GQ magazine 10 years ago, and so that was my first real intro to it. Yeah,
that's really cool. Who do you think is the greatest driver of all time in Formula One?
Lewis Hamilton.
Love coffee or tea?
Love it. Coffee.
Sleep in or up early?
Sleep in.
If you had to pick, and someone said tires, are they interesting or not interesting? Your answer would be?
Several years ago, I would have said not interesting, now very interesting.
Yes! Damn it. Steve is the best! All right, what's your favorite food?
Steak.
What's my favorite?
And that's it.
Oh, I had the follow-up on my favorite food.
No, you didn't get it. But,
too late.
Also, just because... I feel like we've shortchanged, Steve, if we don't ask, although you didn't pick it from the list, is what's your favorite cheese?
Some good old American cheddar cheese.
Love
Excellent.
I love it. So, just about your cap. So, first of all, thank you for doing that. That was awesome. And for the listeners, one note, as we were joking before, I also have a Mercedes cap, and it's a Lewis cap. Mine, it says 44 on it. I bought it a long time ago. And it's interesting because on the brim, mine says powerful beyond measure. And I thought about that for a minute. I'm like, it's actually quite easy to measure. There's horsepower, there's torque, there's 0 to 60 speed. There's like 800 different ways to measure wheel horsepower, engine horsepower. I mean, there's like 800 ways to measure the power of the car, but yet that was their tagline on the hat I bought, powerful beyond measure. I'm like, well, not really, but okay.
Yeah.
You overthink things way too much. That's why you love tires so much.
Yeah. I sat there staring at this hat at the brim like, what? And anyway, so enough about that. So Steve, thanks for doing this. And I would just say, you know, the listeners out there, if you're interested in doing a 100 seconds of DRS, please let us know. Shoot us a link, a note on Twitter at F1 Dirty Side. We'll put the note out again shortly. Steve, thanks so much. This was awesome.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And everyone do it. It's fun. It's a good way to wake up in the morning is get my brain going. So I appreciate it.
Cheers, Steve. Nice to meet you.
Thanks, guys.
Oh, that's so cool. I love getting the listeners on. It's becoming more and more regular now. In fact, we've got a number of them planned out over the next few weeks. We've actually had some real kind of interest and some sign them. I think we've got like 4 or 5 in the bank now. So please keep signing up for this, because it's absolutely awesome to have you guys on and go through that. Now, I don't really want to have to do this, but yes, there's the reminder for the fantasy update this week. Get your teams in. But well, we gave an update from from fantasy last week where I beat Brian. We also had the first round of the Rob versus Brian the draft. Miami was the first track picked, and when we put the numbers through the supercomputer, what did the supercomputer tell everybody, Brian?
I think I won. I think I was victorious, and I'm all right being a bigger man than you and not singing a song like "I beat you, I beat you." See, I don't have to sing it because I beat
you just
you.
Did.
So one weekend. No, I just said what you did. I didn't do it.
It's your song. Yeah. I only sang it back to you when you sang it back to me first. So
yeah. We'll take it. We'll take it. No, it's exciting. Remember, like we said earlier, get your picks in, get your teams in by quali. I hope you guys enjoyed Fangio. I'm so excited for the race next week in Spain. Thanks again for listening, everybody.
Yep. Keep it on the dirty side.